Hello and welcome to another Home is Where the Hearth is podcast. Quick sip of milk before I proceed. I have the window open. It's overcast day, but quite warm, no wind. So if you do hear birds in the background, I can hear blue jays and what have you, then I don't know how sensitive this microphone is, but I hope you'll accept it as sort of authentic background that it's not too irritating. Okay, so without further ado, we're going to conclude our series, not just our 3 weeks on Shakespeare's Macbeth, but just a very quick recap. We've actually had a series based upon the study questions I did for a course on the Christian imagination or imaginative literature, I think, actually, for Memorial College last autumn. And so we've had 15 questions on each of about eight or so texts. So we began with the Iliad by Homer, then we had the Odyssey by Homer, the Aeneid by Virgil, and then we went to Divine Comedy. And then for the Divine Comedy, we actually went to the Canterbury Tales, where we looked at the general prologue, the nun's priest tale, and the wife of Bath's prologue and tale. And then we got to Shakespeare, and we just looked at three of the great tragedies, so not the brightest or breeziest aspect of the bard's work, but the three tragedies, Othello, King Lear, and Macbeth, all written within a very brief span of time, around the time of the reinstitution of anti-Catholic persecution during the early years of the reign of King James I. And that darkness, if you like, is present in those three tragedies. So we'll conclude. I have no idea what we're doing next week for Home is Where the Hearth is. I haven't given any thought yet, but I have 7 days to do so. So expect me to come up with something hopefully good and exciting next week. But for this week, we're going to conclude our discussion of Macbeth with question 11. 11. What does the play reveal about the effects of political corruption on society as a whole? Okay, so again, this is sort of, although obviously there aren't a huge number of characters in the play, it does serve, if you like, as microcosmic political philosophy. In other words, that it's a way of us understanding society as a whole and the political ramifications of certain types of behaviour. So we can project from the stage to the world, or the world's a stage, as Shakespeare says, of course, and learn some lessons. So what does the play reveal about the effects of political corruption on society as a whole? We can see basically when those in power are utterly corrupt and self-seeking, are prepared to do anything necessary to retain their power and consolidate their power and destroy their rivals, we end up with the bloodshed and the violence and the anarchy and the tyranny and the lack of justice that we see in Macbeth, or played out on a grand scale. That's what we see in society when the likes of Macbeth, the tyranny reigns in the corridors of power. So question 12. Macbeth is clearly a Machiavelli in terms of his philosophy and his practical actions. What does this say about Shakespeare's presentation of Machiavellianism? Okay, so just to remind ourselves that Machiavelli wrote a book called The Prince in the early 16th century. So it's a relatively recent title, recent book when Shakespeare's writing, under 100 years anyway, from the time of the publication of The Prince to Shakespeare's writing of Macbeth. And basically, Machiavelli's Prince is about how to use power for one's own self-serving purposes. And so the Machiavelli, the one who abandons, relinquishes, scorns traditional virtue and concepts of self-sacrificial love in order to have self-serving power, is basically the perennial villain. I was going to say the archetypal villain. The Machiavelli was the archetype, but there are many Machiavellian types in Shakespeare's plays. Very often his villains are these Machiavellian figures. we think perhaps of Iago in Othello, which we looked at already, about Edmund and Regan and Goneril and Cornwall in King Lear, King Claudius and Polonius in Hamlet, etc. So Macbeth is certainly a Machiavellian in this sense of the word. He will stop at nothing to retain and sustain and strengthen his own political hold, his own power. And clearly the fact that Shakespeare's villains are Machiavellian and his heroes and heroines are conventionally Christian in terms of their moral perspective and their virtue shows us very clearly where Shakespeare stands on the theological, philosophical and political spectrum. Question 13. What's the tension and interplay between fortune, providence and free will in the play? Can they coexist? If not, which are real and which illusory? I'd about to say a great question, but as I wrote it myself, I perhaps I shouldn't say that, but I've certainly forgotten about it as a question. You know, one of the, I'm actually teaching at the moment for Red Cultural, that's a group in Chile, Oedipus Rex, or at least I will start teaching it tomorrow. And one of the big questions of that play, as of Macbeth, is what is fortune or fate or destiny on the one hand, should we say, and what is providence? Is there a difference between the two? And where does free will fit into this? Well, you know, blind fortune or the sort of the destiny of preordained future where the gods basically know exactly what's going to happen and there's nothing you can do to change it, that you're just a slave to fate, this fatalistic approach, is clearly not the same as as providence, where basically there are consequences for actions, and ultimately God, in his omniscience, sees and knows the consequences that follow on from actions, but it is the actions themselves which are a consequence of free will that plays itself out in human history. So basically, fortune and providence are not compatible. And do they coexist? Well, you know, you could say that something is blind chance, like if I toss a coin. And is that the same thing as providence? Well, that's a good question. I would argue that providence is the presence of the divine in human history, in the working of things, so that the interplay between free will and consequence ultimately serves the will of God, at least in the longer term. Fortune is something that, if it exists at all, blind fate, as in the tossing of a coin, pure chance, shall we say, it's something which exists in parallel and certainly doesn't contradict and is ultimately subservient to providence. Whether or not even the tossing of a coin is without some providential dimension is something beyond my ability to plumb those mystical depths. But clearly what's important here is that the more that Macbeth falls into a nihilistic following of his own passions, his desire for power, that requires one monstrosity, one monstrous act after another, that he seems to actually, his free will seems to be compromised. I'm not saying it ceases to exist, but it's as if in the end he becomes a slave to the temptation that he succumbed to at the beginning of the play in listening to the temptation of the three witches or the weird sisters. So I think it is true that if we become sinful in our habits, we become slaves to those habits, we become addicts, and addiction is not freedom. So I think up to a point that Macbeth pays the price for his initial willingness, and use the word willingness advisingly here, allowing his will to be persuaded by demonic temptation. In the end, he's following a path which almost seems to be preordained, because he no longer seems able to break himself away from it. His will is compromised. He becomes addicted to his own lust for power and his own desire to have his own passions self-gratified. Okay, question 14, which is a long one, a long question, in fact, several questions. Think of the darkness of the play. How much of the action of the play occurs under cover of night? Is the night and the darkness omnipresent? Are there days on which we can feel the light and the warmth of the sun? How does this affect the interior state of the characters? Consider the different manifestations of blindness, moral blindness to the consequences of actions, blindness to danger, blindness to deceit. How much of sight is connected to an inner understanding of the moral underpinnings of reality? And again, looking for parallels with Oedipus Rex, and indeed with, let's just stay with Oedipus Rex and Antigone, that Tiresias, the blind prophet, of course, sees more clearly than those with eyes, because he has an understanding of the inner reality, the spiritual reality, that inner sight, that wisdom. And that there's the eye of wisdom, which is distinct from physical eyes that may be blind, even though they see physical things. If they're blind to metaphysical reality, they are nonetheless blind to the deeper reality in which we find ourselves. As for darkness and night, Shakespeare is a master at having the form of the play fit the theme. So we Romeo and Juliet, in their self-centered idealization of, self-centered, the self as the two of them against the rest of the world, Romeo and Juliet contra mundum, that they in their blind passion, they allow reason to pander will, which is something which Hamlet says is always perilous. Then we put our reason to the service of our desire, rather than allowing our desire to be a servant of reason. Then we get ourselves in all sorts of trouble. So the night as a figure in Romeo and Juliet is omnipresent. And it's also omnipresent to an even greater degree, in fact, in Macbeth. We don't see daylight. We don't see sunlight. Everything's in shadow. Everything's in darkness. The microcosmos that Shakespeare presents to us is one which is an expression of the darkness of the sin, which is animating the action. So we do see this darkness as reflective of different types of blindness. So the blindness that are consequence of actions. Macbeth and Lady Macbeth don't realize when they commit the first sin how many other sins will be following in its train. Blindness to danger. There's a recklessness to ambition that doesn't look at the consequences of the action, the dangers inherent in a certain course of action. Blindness to deceit. Again, right at the beginning of the play, that Macbeth so much wants to believe what the weird sisters are telling him, that he is blind to the deception that underpins it, that yes, he might get some things that they're saying superficially, but only at the cost of his own self-destruction and the destruction of his wife. So sight, being able to see, is connected to an inner understanding of the moral underpinnings of reality, that sight ultimately depended upon metaphysics and not just physics. And finally, question 15, does Macbeth have a happy ending? If so, why? If not, why not? I like to ask this question of the of my students when we are doing one of Shakespeare's tragedies. At the end of Hamlet, almost everybody's dead. At the end of Macbeth, there's a lot of people dead, including, of course, Macbeth and his wife. Can we consider these happy endings? Well, it depends what you mean by happy. I mean, have these people found pleasure in their self-seeking, self-gratification? No, they have not. But a happy ending is where basically justice is done, that virtue is served, that the goodness of the cosmos is upheld, where the will of God his, in his providence is seen to be played out. So An unhappy ending would have been if Macbeth, having murdered all those people, could sit on the throne comfortably and rule without any problem. That would be an unhappy ending, because it would show that injustice and murder and cynicism and the hatred of one's neighbour can actually prosper. That would be a decidedly unhappy ending. Instead, we find that if we follow a path of self-deception prompted by demonic temptation, then we will end up doing destructive things to others that end up being self-destructive. That's the moral of the play. That's a good moral. And as that good moral is seen to triumph at the end, we can indeed call the ending of Macbeth, I would say, a happy ending, a joyous ending, an ending which shows that God is in his heaven and ultimately all is well thereby. Okay, thanks so much again for joining me in this week's Home is Where the Hearth Is podcast. Please join me next week when I don't know what we'll be talking about. But between now and next week, I will know and you will find out. Thanks again for being a member of the Inner Sanctum and for joining me. Until next week, have a blessed Passion Tide and also a blessed Holy Week to come. Goodbye.